Hey now, we are getting over, and I am the Silver King, Adam Silverstein, here to lead you through these hard times. Da-da. With episode 587 of your favorite professional wrestling podcast. That's right, Getting Over is back once again, and it is Thursday, so you know what that means. We are here to talk everything that happened over the last week across NXT and AEW. AEW, obviously, coming out of Dynasty, its second pay-per-view of 2024, while NXT was presenting the first of a two-week special on television, NXT Spring Break-In. We had major developments across both shows. We have an absolute ton to talk about on this episode of the Getting Over Wrestling podcast. And given the time that we happen to be taping this on Thursday, we actually have the opportunity to discuss the ratings of these shows, which is not something we normally do, sometimes because of the timing of the taping, but largely because that's not what we're really about here. However, the ratings this week are particularly interesting, so we will be covering them at the end of the show. With all of that said, allow me to get you into it right away with a reminder that the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast
is all about Defy.
So be sure to head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave 5-star ratings on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. And please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover, sign up. You will get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant reactions to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with exclusive news posts every single Friday. Again, that is buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Now, as I mentioned, we have a ton to get to on today's show. We will get to it momentarily. First, I want to give you a quick reminder about the two episodes we already have in the can this week. First, the WWE episode published on Tuesday featuring Becky Lynch winning the Women's World Championship. Some big changes to the bloodline. Finn Balor seemingly re-signing with WWE and a ton more. Then we came back on Wednesday, gave you a second WWE episode, a WWE draft special where Vintage Chris Vanini and the Silver King made mock draft picks for SmackDown and Raw. We put together a comprehensive show. We also answered some listener questions and covered additional WWE news. It is not an episode you want to miss. And that makes this the third episode of the week. And we have been cranking them out ever since WrestleMania week. I promise you, the Silver King is excited to rest those vocal cords and fully tune into the NFL draft over the next 3 nights, because he is not only a huge Miami Dolphins fan, but he also is just thrilled to get the opportunity to not do a million podcasts all the way over a weekend going into the next week. So we should be back to normal next week. The WrestleMania 40 notebook is cleared. Two shows, Tuesday, WWE, Thursday, NXT and AEW. We're getting back on track. We also have a number of irons in the fire for potential interviews, both with WWE and AEW, and those could be coming down the pike sooner than later. Now, we are going to discuss NXT on this show. We are going to discuss AEW on this show.
But I'm afraid I've got some news.
And I believe this is the first time we've ever done a segment like this on this Thursday episode, but I have a bunch of stuff from NXT and AEW to discuss. So let's go ahead and do it real quick before we get into everything else that is going down on the show. First, coming out of Dynasty, look, I felt it was appropriate to address comments made by both Brian Cage and Tony Storm, both of whom, one way or another, were referencing Cody Rhodes. Now, as far as Brian Cage goes, he's the one that I actually want to talk about. He tweeted at the end of Bryan Danielson against Will Ospreay, "I don't care what story you finish, that was the match of the year, Will Ospreay versus Bryan Danielson." And this comes out of a period of time, obviously preceding the release of the All-In footage, where AEW sent Adam Copeland out to the ring and Tony Khan said stuff and other people said stuff. Hey, let's get rid of the tribalism in wrestling. Why are we doing this? Let's just all enjoy this product that we love so much. Meanwhile, Brian Cage, his first thought after witnessing an iconic match, which I praised as much, if not more than anyone, coming out of Dynasty, his first thought is, I got to shit on Cody Rhodes and WWE. So, Brian Cage,
off is a direction you can fuck.
Now, similarly, but quite different, I want to be very clear about this. Tony Storm in the AEW Dynasty scrum, the media press conference type of deal they do after pay-per-view, she made some type of offhand comment to Tony Khan saying, don't worry, Tony, no matter how many times I successfully defend my title or however many titles I win, whatever she said, I'm never going to call you out to the ring to celebrate with me. I found that to be lighthearted and fun and in character. She wasn't shitting on Cody so much as she was referencing something that happened. Cody, of course, calling out Paul Levesque and Bruce Pritchard and other people after WrestleMania 40. So for me, completely different sides of the coin. I already told you what I thought about Brian Cage. Tony Storm, funny as usual. Good on you. But in totality, just to kind of wrap up this part of the news segment, let me just say, and let me just remind really, Cody Rhodes is one of the main reasons AEW exists, period. But why anyone in that company would dare take shots at Cody Rhodes, a guy who has said nothing but positive things about AEW since leaving, how proud he is of their continued existence and success. He is only nice to them. Why anyone would feel the need to take shots at him unless he specifically and directly wronged them is absolutely insane to me. So that's the way I'll wrap that up. Goldberg, yes, Goldberg, recently said he's spoken with Tony Khan multiple times, but bluntly, AEW was, quote, too cheesy for him, and he couldn't, quote, look himself in the mirror if he went there. There are pretty much two things that even the most tribal WWE and AEW fans can agree on right now. None of them want the Hardys or Goldberg on their roster. So I'm not sure the guy should really be thumbing his nose at a potential paid opportunity. He doesn't have that many earning years left. And if AEW and Tony Khan were actually interested in him, to thumb your nose at them and call them too cheesy. And look, I've criticized AEW for some of their booking, sure. But for him to like make it a non-starter, I mean, dude, grow up. Like, what are you talking about here? It really did feel like an outdated take to me, though. To be fair, there are other legends who have said similar things, not necessarily to that level. So perhaps it's like a feeling that permeates the industry to a degree with people who have gone through it before. That doesn't make it right, though. And I just didn't like the way Goldberg came off when he said those things about AEW. Back to NXT. So NXT Battleground has been moved. Instead of being held at an arena in Savannah, Georgia, as originally scheduled, and I actually believe it was on a Sunday night with Raw at that same arena happening the next day, the idea to sell ticket packages and get a bunch of people really hyped up to watch two shows. Instead of that, it's going to be held at the UFC Apex in Las Vegas. And I just got to tell you all, I don't get this one bit. It's nearly an identical, sterile environment to the WWE Performance Center. And you know what? It's more sterile now that I think about it, especially given what we saw of the PC on Tuesday night. Small group of fans, I think maximum might be 1,000. More likely they'll get 400, 500, 600. The visuals are dog shit. It does not scream premium live event to hold something in there. You're not giving talent exposure to larger or more unique crowds. Even if there's a cost savings in the short term, I hardly see how it's beneficial in the long term to take your NXT talent from basically one performance center and put them into another. It just doesn't make any sense to me why they're doing this. Again, the only reason can be financial, and I don't believe that's a good enough reason to actually have this event at UFC Apex. I truly hope they prove me wrong. I hope when we see it on Peacock, we are blown away and we're like, wow, this was such a cool, unique idea for them to do it here. I just don't think that's going to be the case. Now, if you want to move it to Vegas and put it in the Sphere, okay, then maybe you might get me going along with something unique and interesting. But UFC Apex, I'm sorry. Off the top,
I don't like that.
I don't like it at all. Von Wagner was among that string of WWE releases that hit late last week into early this week. And look, it sucks, right? For anyone to lose their job. We've been talking about it on this podcast for months. I kind of feel like years at this point. So it's hard to say that I'm surprised by it. There just wasn't progress from him. And they tried so many different things. They tried to tug on the emotional heartstrings. They tried to make him a comedic character. They tried him as a good guy, as a bad guy. It just never worked. And it was clear, unfortunately, that it was never going to work from pretty much when he debuted. And he had that feud and series with Kyle O'Reilly. And you're just like, this guy is not going to make it in WWE. And it's unfortunate because he seems like a sweet guy. But if you want to talk about the releases and, you know, we go through each one individually, how surprised are we? How upset are we? Unfortunately, this is one of those situations where I'm just not surprised. But what's really interesting about Von Wagner is he actually created like a legacy to a degree in NXT. There were some individual moments that would make you laugh or pop, and obviously none of them more so than Come Tuesday, which people still quote to this day. But the time where he confronted Dijak in the ring and he was wearing sunglasses and he thought it was like some big shot. Hey, Dijak, you idiot. Why are you wearing sunglasses? We're inside. Like that's going to be memorable. I believe there was a quote where he's like, I love that idea, which was very funny. The Cosmic Brownies, the baby photo of him and that entire storyline. The powerbomb through the announce table where Vic Joseph's candy just went flying everywhere. Obviously, the one where he like looks around the corner and winks at the camera. Like for a guy who really didn't have much of a ceiling in NXT or in WWE, he actually did leave us with like a handful of memorable moments where when you look back on NXT 2.0 and the transition into this white and gold era, you're going to say, oh yeah, Von Wagner, like he had a couple things that made me laugh. So unfortunate for him. I hope he has success on the independents. I hope he continues wrestling. You never know what can happen. Maybe he comes back one day, figures it all out. But again, was I surprised? Unfortunately, I was not surprised. Matt Hardy is a free agent now, and he returned to TNA, but apparently did not sign with them full time. Also, Jeff Hardy's contract with AEW is up earlier than originally thought, according to Fightful. So it's fair to assume that he follows Matt. Could see them doing TNA, independence, then maybe eventually down the line, taking the Legends contract from WWE, having one last like super short run, maybe going into a WrestleMania match, like a retirement match or something, getting inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame, etc. But Hardy, Matt, not with AEW. Hardy, Jeff, probably not with AEW pretty soon, I guess. We don't know the end date of the contract exactly. Grizzled Young Vets, they will be making their AEW debuts on Collision this Saturday night against the Acclaimed. It was not announced whether they have signed. It seems fair to assume it's either happened or perhaps it will eventually, but they've been doing independence. They've been working for TNA. They're complete free agents right now. So maybe they're just dipping their toe into AEW like Matt Cardona has done previously, and they're not going to get signed. Still very much TBD. There also, though, is a full expectation that MCMG will sign with AEW if they have not already. So different from GYV, there may or may not. We don't know the entire situation. MCMG, from what I have heard, they will or have already signed with AEW. And lastly here, I did want to address something else. And like, I really thought we were past this, but it got into the news cycle again. And it was Triple H's comments from the Pat McAfee show, which were assumed to be about Will Ospreay, even though he never said Will Ospreay, and it could have applied to myriad people, and he may well have been talking about a group of people, not just a singular individual. Wouldn't you know it, but the other person who has been commenting about this on their radio show, which is not a radio show, but whatever, had this to say a couple days ago. Quote, those Triple H comments, referring to those about Will Ospreay supposedly, aged like stale milk. There is no way you can watch this guy with any kind of straight face and go, he's not good enough for us. And again, I want to remind everyone, Paul Levesque never said, A, anything about Will Ospreay. B, he certainly never said in any way that Ospreay or the general person he was talking about was not good enough for WWE. The fact that Triple H made overtures to try to sign Will Ospreay and wanted him as part of the company shows that he was good enough for WWE. And I think anyone who's ever seen Will Ospreay wrestle a match or recently cut a promo knows he is most certainly good enough for WWE. So I was just blown away that a comment, an innocuous comment that Twitter took to mean it was about Will Ospreay. And we already went through this whole conversation. I'm not going to do the whole thing again. But I'm blown away that something like that, which we tried to put to bed last week, which was already addressed, and this news cycle had moved on, can get brought back up in such a way where it's not only like the clip getting cut off and assumptions being made about the clip, but now it's literal misquoting and injecting opinion into something that was not there previously. It is absolute bullshit. It is exactly why there is tribalism in wrestling, stirring the pot when something wasn't even said. And it's absolutely ridiculous, especially from a journalistic standpoint. So I just had to get that out there. I'm ready to move on. I had been ready to move on. And I'm also ready to move on with this show because we have a ton to talk about across NXT and AEW this week. We are going to start with NXT spring break in week one. We will move to AEW, where the vast majority of that conversation is going to be about Dynamite on Wednesday, which, spoiler alert, the Silver King liked very much, at least the vast majority of the show. So we will have timestamps in the episode description. If you want to listen to one section or the other, you have the opportunity to jump around. But as always, I truly do hope you listen to the entire show. So let's move to NXT spring breakin' week one. NXT opened with Ava, Adam Pearce, and Nick Aldis commiserating about the WWE draft. The guys talked about having eyes on numerous talents, particularly in the women's division. Ava said she's confident NXT will never be the same once the show is over. Now, briefly, before we get into the rest of NXT, WWE did announce the rules for the draft. At nowhere in the rules does it note NXT getting selections in the draft. So even though the logo includes gold for NXT and the word draft in the logo is literally the same font that they're using for the NXT logo, despite all of that, NXT is not part of the draft any more than it has been in the past, meaning that its superstars, its wrestlers, can get called up to SmackDown and Raw. And that's totally fine. Maybe there'll be something on the back end where next week NXT is able to like refill its roster based on the number of people that were taken from it. Still to be determined. Just wanted to make it clear for everyone, because obviously you're going to listen to this, most of you, many of you, before the WWE draft. NXT will not have picks, at least not as WWE has laid it out. Let's move from that and get fully into NXT spring breakin'. The NXT championship was on the line in the main event, Ilya Dragunov defending against Trick Williams. The stipulation here was that Trick would be forced to leave NXT if he did not win the title, but there was no such stipulation for Dragunov. As I said when this was announced, the stip really came out of nowhere. Dragunov has never disrespected Williams, nor did he have any reason to want to jettison him from the brand. It felt like raising the stakes for the sake of raising stakes and nothing more. So that bothered me coming into it. Now, the Creed brothers and Ivy Nile were backstage saying they wouldn't miss this show for the world. They appreciated the momentum that Trick has picked up and predicted that he would slay the dragon. It was corny, but it was nice to see them back in NXT. JD McDonagh later gave his prediction for Dragunov, saying the only way to beat him was to hospitalize him, and Williams does not have that in his bag. New Catch Republic was next into the fray. Pete Dunne picked Ilya. Tyler Bate sided with Trick. Williams was later on the phone with his mom. It was made to sound like she has a health scare, so he told her to fight. We would later learn, I believe on a social media promo after everything was over, that she's in the hospital with a heart condition. So obviously best wishes to her. Johnny Gargano then popped in as Trick shared that he was feeling the most pressure of his entire life. Johnny said, quote, no pressure, no diamonds, and that he needs to use all of his prior losses and the betrayal that he felt from Carmelo Hayes to make himself stronger. Gargano said, no one has beaten the best version of Trick Williams. He related his own experience and he gave him a huge pep talk that got Trick prepared for the match. This was an awesome segment. Like the huge monster baby face of NXT Black and Gold, Johnny Gargano, with the huge monster baby face of NXT White and Gold, Trick Williams. Super cool. Now, all the folks that we already mentioned, they took front row seats for the match. Now, before the match, Dragunov said he's forever unbreakable no matter what Williams has in his bag. Damian Priest then stepped into the screen to stare him down for a bit before putting his arm around the female interviewer, and he immediately reverted to his old NXT character. He was like, how you doing? Which was very funny, because I want that Damian Priest on the main roster. Trick was then interviewed saying he's either going to go out as champion or a bust because he fears no man. He's confident in whatever outcome happens on the show. NXT did everything possible to make this match feel like the biggest deal in the entire world. And that was such a stark contrast to what happened on Raw with the Women's World Championship. Different circumstances, I get it. Still, WWE on Raw could have done portions of what NXT did to make that match and that title win feel as big as this one did. Let's move to the match itself. Williams missed trick shot at the bell, and he ate Constantine special for an early flat two count. Just a few minutes in, they dapped each other up, hugged, and exchanged huge blows out of respect. They botched a sunset flip powerbomb with Trick holding the ropes too long and landing on Ilya's chest. He was okay, came back hitting coast to coast. Williams countered a flying senton with half of a neck breaker, adding a powerbomb and Ilya's own H-bomb. Then he hit Dragunov's Torpedo Moscow on him for a false finish. Ilya came back with a Death Valley driver in the corner, but when he went outside, Trick hit a bookend off the barricade through the announce table. The Creeds went crazy in the crowd seeing this. Dragunov superplexed Williams off the apron and hit an H-bomb. Then he dragged him to the corner for a super H-bomb and a false finish. Then he hit an atomic H-bomb from the top rope, but he sold the wrist from Tony D'Angelo and Stax, the one they injured ahead of the last title match. He delayed his cover because of that. And because the cover was delayed, Trick kicked out. Williams bounced out of a German suplex and hit Trick shot to Dragunov's back for a near fall. Then they repeated the corner-to-corner finish from their last match. This time, Trick shot beat out Torpedo Moscow as Williams got the 1-2-3 with Trick Willie becoming the new NXT champion in 12-plus minutes. And folks, the PC straight up exploded to the point that the cameras naturally shook. No doubt the biggest pop in the history of that building. And let's remember, that building, the Silver King was there for John Cena and The Undertaker showing up. And they were going crazy, but it was a different kind of crazy than this. This was probably one of the biggest NXT pops ever between the PC and Full Sail as well. Ilya stole the title away from the referee, handed it to Trick, hugged him like a proud father seeing his son graduate. Trick jumped into the crowd, and Vic Joseph absolutely nailed the call.
Trick shot! Trick shot! Trick shot! Booker! William Slade! The Mad Dragon! Here's your winner!
That's actually not the clip I meant to play. It was this one.
Tonight, Trick gave every ounce of energy, every ounce of himself to slay the Mad Dragon from a sidekick to a champion. This is a new era being led by Trick Williams. That's all it is, and that's all it's gonna be.
I know Michael Cole likes to talk about Corey Graves being the heir apparent. I'm sorry, you can't listen to that and not think Vic Joseph is the heir apparent for Michael Cole. The level to which I loved this match cannot be exaggerated. No, it was not the best technical ring work. Couple key mistakes from Trick showing he is still green. He's been wrestling for 2.5 years. He was undoubtedly nervous as hell. He's been wrestling as a singles performer for like a year. But Ilya was extraordinary. Truly top five wrestler in the world level. The way he sold for Trick, the emotional and physical storytelling he delivered, the way he put Trick over both during and after the match. Dragunov did whatever he could to make Williams, not just in this match, over the last few months, and he succeeded. This concluded a top two or three NXT championship run of all time for Dragunov. Ilya has been incredible during this run ever since moving to the United States. He deserves more than flowers. This dude is a no doubt top 10 wrestler in the world. And folks, he's not 10, he's not 9, and he's certainly not 8 either. Vic and Booker T, they were effing phenomenal on commentary. Booker was in his element, especially during the bookend spot. The storytelling was immense, starting with intensity, moving into the brotherhood aspect that they previously showed on screen. And that's why I hated the stipulation for the match. It didn't compute with that. Then, returning to intensity down the stretch. Not only did they work in the wrist injury from the D'Angelo situation, that helped Dragunov excuse the loss, but they called back to the finish from their last meeting, with the only difference in the outcome being the one who connected with the move when they tried to go for it simultaneously. It again helped Ilya save face in defeat. My only wish was that this thing had 5 more minutes. 12 felt unnecessarily short. And now Trick, man, his meteoric rise has been outstanding to watch. He is such an effing star. Just like Bron Breakker a couple years ago, he has such a long way to go to be fully ready for the main roster. But the fact that he's come this far this quickly, despite, like I said, only being a singles competitor for about a year, is just ridiculous. It did feel like a total sea change in NXT with this title flipping. The main event scene is going to be completely different, and it's going to be interesting to see how the roster looks after the draft is over. This, folks, was simply excellent. 4.25 stars and an A, but I mean, the moment of him winning, it's a five-star moment, obviously, but the match and everything, when you put it all together, 4.25 stars and an A. Other notes I had here. The production camera is shaking during that three count in the celebration. They were such an incredible visual. For those who don't know, the seating in the Performance Center is basically metal bleacher risers that are all connected to one another. So you feel vibrations and movement and stuff, even though they're pretty steady in general. There were a couple times when I was there for that super show with Cena and Taker where that shit was rocking in a major way. And some of the camera platforms are actually attached to the risers, which explains why the cameras look the way they did. But still, it takes a significant amount of movement for the cameras to get shifted in that manner. And the visual that you got from the camera shaking while the fans were chanting, "Whoop that trick," it was outstanding and straight up legendary. All in all, this was probably one of the top 3 to 5 moments in NXT history, and it wrapped up one of the best episodes of NXT in the brand's history. Obviously, we have a ton more to discuss on the show, but this was basically a perfect main event, an absolute sprint with real solid wrestling, a great announce table shot, top-tier crowd, fully invested, commentary on point, and those fans, they were aligned in just wanting a specific result, and it delivered for them. Really tough to beat that. And in retrospect, I thought this Tuesday night, and I think it even more now as I'm talking about it, I really wish I had driven up to Orlando and gone. Like, I forget how easy it is for me to do that. It is a pain in the ass. I got to get a hotel room, you know, got to make time in my life to do the drive both ways. But when there's a situation like this unfolding where you know there's going to be a result that you want to see, I just should have made the drive. That was a big mistake for the Silver King. Doesn't, of course, take away from the incredible moment itself. And speaking of great stuff from this episode of NXT, let's go from the main event to the opening match. The women's championship was on the line. Roxanne Perez defending against Lyra Valkyria and Tatum Paxley. This opened the show, like I said, with the women already in the ring and Roxy hugging her title tight. It started really hot with constant action that continued through the break as Lyra hit a great fisherman's buster on Tatum. There's a really cool double crossface sequence. Then Roxy hit a combination inverted regular DDT on the challengers. Valkyria hit a nice counter German suplex on Perez, who got pounced off Paxley's back while she was trying Pop Rocks, only to eat Valkyria's old roundhouse kick finisher. Tatum then hit a really sick pump handle turnover slam, which Paige used to do, as the Paige turner. She did that on Lyra, plus a 450 pretty deep into the ring. Let me repeat that. Tatum Paxley hit a 450. When did you know that she could hit a 450? I certainly didn't. Roxy broke the cover by flipping Tatum over for a jackknife cover 1-2-3 to retain the title in 12 minutes. The crowd went apoplectic for Paxley in the finish here. That two-move combo, look, I'm not saying she's as good of a wrestler as any other women's wrestler, but that two-move combo is as good a combo as any other women's wrestler currently possesses. Where the hell has she been hiding that shit? This was a star-making moment for Tatum, especially coming out of the criticism, unfounded criticism, let's remind you, that she received about 1 week ago. She should be treated with rocket fuel now. This was a mini banger from the three of them. Roxy looked as good as she has since joining WWE. This was easily Tatum's best match with the entire company. Lyra was the glue of the match. Plus, the energy and the atmosphere was off the charts. I wish there was no commercial because that broke it up just a little bit. But I'll tell you, folks, it was a 4-star A-minus match, and it kind of came out of nowhere. This was awesome. It seems like a number of people had an expectation that Perez would lose this match and get called up to the main roster. As we told you last week and multiple times before, yeah, she could slot in and hang with the WWE women. She's also 22 years old, and there should be no rush whatsoever to send her up. An extra year of seasoning, just like Bron Breakker got before his call-up, will do her so well. She's already thriving as a heel, but still has areas in which she can improve. It should be a nice long title run, I would hope, before a move in next year's draft. Maybe they bring her up sooner. Maybe she gets drafted, but she remains in NXT. And then once she drops the title, she moves up. There's a lot of different things they can do. But for me, I wouldn't have her in the draft. I would just keep her in NXT for another year, bring her up after that. Maybe you do something cool with Cora Jade to send her off. That is the way you book Roxanne Perez. Let's move to what I didn't even realize coming into the show was a beach brawl match. Sol Ruka against Blair Davenport. This started with Sol countering a boogie board shot from Blair with a surfboard shot. There was also a cool twisting X-Factor into a kiddie pool before Ruka put the surfboard on top of Davenport, stomped it, and rode on top. Blair came back by slamming Ruka into the elevated surfboard, which cracked it in half. Sol did a flip over super kick, and then a standing moonsault with a boogie board before drilling Blair in the face with it. Really nasty shot. Ruka also did like an F5 style powerbomb, which was really sick. Call that like a typhoon or something. It's a really good move. Blair prevented Sol Snatcher, then pushed Sol off the barricade to prevent a cartwheel DDT. Credit to the fans, because they had a pretty funny chant during this match. Cowabunga, surf's up, dude. Just thought that was pretty cool. Ruka got Davenport on her back, slamming her off the barricade through a picnic table. The thing exploded. She added a springboard Sol Snatcher with Blair's head landing on a boogie board for the win. And folks, what did I just talk about? The other women's match over-delivering? This one might have over-delivered even more. Because let me tell you this, coming out of this beach, was it beach brawl? Yeah, beach brawl. Sol Ruka has
it
officially. Best match of her career by a mile. She is fully recovered from that torn ACL. She looks like she's headed to the top of this women's division in short order. If Sol puts it all together, we're talking about a multi-time main roster women's champion and a future star. She's only 24. She is more capable in the ring than folks 10 years older than her. She needs to continue improving in pretty much every area, including ring work, presence, promos, but you can see the beginnings of a legit superstar here. Davenport sold her ass off throughout this match, as I theorized last week. I could definitely see a call-up coming out of this. She hasn't really done much since coming over from NXT UK last year, and she's now been in the WWE system for about 3 years, which likely means that she's near the end of that initial deal. So they're going to have to decide whether to extend her, move her up, or get rid of her. And clearly they did not release her. So I have to believe that she's going to get called up to the main roster. I could also see Blair being one of the beneficiaries of any relationship that WWE eventually has with Marigold, because she did wrestle for like 5 years under Rossi Ogawa in Stardom. If it's not up to the main roster for her, then Blair should be moved to the top of the NXT women's division in the title picture. And maybe she should even be the person to beat Roxy for the title. Something worth considering there. Anyway, as far as the match, it's so tough because in a gimmick match like this, you really don't want to go too high. It's definitely 3.5 stars. And if you were a little bit higher at like 3.75, I'd be totally okay if a B+ grade was given to this. It's right on the line between those. Super, super fun. No Quarter Catch Crew fought D'Angelo Family in a 6-man tag team match. Damon Kemp had a nice running somersault off the apron, which crushed everyone ringside. Tony D'Angelo got a huge hot tag and ran through everyone. Kemp went to double stomp him to break a fall, but instead he nailed Dempsey. So Charlie took out Tony's knee. No Quarter hit a slingshot suplex neckbreaker. Dempsey did a double underhook suplex with a bridge that failed because he didn't get his shoulders down. Luca Crucifino and Stax combined for Shatter Machine on Miles Bourne, and D'Angelo escaped the full Nelson, sending Dempsey into the ropes for a catch, power, spinebuster, and the 1-2-3. This, again, exceeded expectations. D'Angelo put Dempsey through the mat with that spinebuster. Was not at all excited for this match when it was first booked. They all delivered while simultaneously setting up an odd Heritage Cup match, I guess, for Tony, either next week or soon after that. Final Testament did a promo package with Karrion Kross saying they were going to take NXT back to the good old days where they ran the entire show. Paul Ellering said Authors of Pain would dominate and Final Testament would come for all the titles. Then the screen flashed saying, quote, black and gold never dies. Axiom and Nathan Frazier were understandably bothered by watching this in the locker room. Malik Blade had their back saying they wouldn't let AOP take over the division. Good Brothers then came in acting like they were NXT lifers, also wanting to protect the division, when Idris Inoue suddenly dropped a mirror, shattering it, and apparently giving himself even more bad luck than he's already had recently. Now, it'd be quite surprising if these guys went from WrestleMania match, Final Testament I'm talking about, to NXT while all staying on main roster contracts. It does make sense to use Axiom and Frazier as transitional champions to AOP, so like if that's what they do, okay, I get it. But while I love the concept of them representing black and gold, I don't particularly love the idea of these guys potentially winning all the titles. That would make NXT I don't want to say a non-watch for me, but far less interesting than it currently is. Thea Hale backstage told her friends that she was happy. She had them and Chase U in her life, and she was prepared to get revenge on JC Jane next week. Jada Parker couldn't stand hearing Thea, Fallon Henley, and Kalani Jordan all be goody two-shoes, so she talked shit and shoved Fallon, leading to a pull-apart brawl. Henley's new haircut kind of had her looking like a late 90s soccer mom. I don't know about that. Hale was solid leading the segment. Parker's expressions behind their backs were great. Nice building block just to create a match. We had Henley against Parker. This started during a picture-in-picture break. Jada did that step-up ass taunt, I guess is what we can call it. Much later, she flung Fallon into the middle rope, and as she ricocheted off, Parker Carter running with that, it's not really a hip attack, it's like a thigh attack, right? To the side of the head for an upset victory. I'm shocked in a vacuum that Jada beat Fallon. It makes sense the most if Henley is getting called up or if they're doing a larger feud or a losing streak storyline or something like that. Fallon looked like she was headed to the top of the women's division as it reshuffled after the draft, but she's 29. She's been in NXT for about 3 years. It's probably time for her to move up. She's 100% ready for the main roster, and she's proven that over much of the last year. JC Jane then cut a backstage promo on Thea after this match, saying she deserves a thank you from Hale after Jane made her everything she wanted to be, but instead, she's been an ungrateful little girl, and she's going to end her. Baron Corbin was being interviewed about the post-match moment with Bron Breakker last week when Lexus King walked up saying he heard Corbin was leaving NXT and brought him a gift basket of his own, and it was gear and a bunch of stuff like that. Corbin said he's not sure where King heard that, but it's probably other people hoping he will leave. Then he suggested Baron just link up with him and make him the next second-generation star who's his partner and also the star whose talent exceeds him, so on and so forth. Basically replacing Breakker, that was the idea. It was interesting, I would say. As I've said before, I really hope Corbin gets called up with Breakker as a tag team. They work so well together. It makes so much sense to do it. King was good here, though, and it was a smart way to kind of tie the past into the present and create a match for the show. So we had Corbin against King. Alexis got a ton of offense until Baron depleted him with a lariat. Corbin hit a really cool vertical suplex-style cutter. Not sure I've really seen that before. King tried cheating with the ropes on a fall. He got caught. Corbin came back with a Death Valley driver. King avoided end of days, pushing him into the referee before hitting a blatant low blow and adding the coronation for the win. If Corbin is staying in NXT, this was a smart finish leading to a rematch. If Corbin is getting called up, it's a smart way for Lexus to get a win without diminishing Corbin too much on the way out. It might have been King's best match in NXT, and Corbin does look replenished. So again, I hope he is part of the draft. Ridge Holland in the parking lot said it's been a rough few weeks and he's ready to earn wins and do everything the right way. Sean Spears got in his way, demanding Holland embrace his demons, but Ridge wouldn't be swayed, smiling and walking away from Spears. Whatever the original idea with the retirement angle, this entire deal has been botched. It hasn't made Holland any better or more interesting. If anything, it's just immensely convoluted and does not make a shred of sense. I have no idea what they were thinking with this entire storyline.
It's got about as much chance of getting over as Orange Cassidy.
Tyson DuPont and Tyreek Igwe, I believe is how you say the name, they got a short video promo package saying they were debuting on NXT next week and they're not afraid of going up against anyone. Now, these are two big, meaty men who almost assuredly will be slapping some meat.
Big, meaty men slapping meat.
They've had 26 career matches, all of them together on NXT Level Up and NXT Live events, basically house shows. None of those matches have lasted longer than 7 minutes. Both guys were track and field throwers collegiately. Tyson is Rickson Opont from South Alabama. Tyreek is, and I know I'm going to botch this name, Chuksum Inweki from Eastern Michigan. I hope I did that somewhat justice. They seem to have a lot of personality along with a good look overall. They're rocking Tims. We'll evaluate next week when we actually see them in the ring. Now that mostly wraps up NXT. There was one additional segment we're going to discuss momentarily as we give you a brief NXT spring break in week two preview. Of course, we do have Thea Hale against JC Jane, and it does feel like in order for this storyline to actually conclude, we need Thea to win this match. It's also maybe somewhat possible JC gets called up to the main roster as part of the WWE draft, so this would make sense as a way to extricate her from NXT. But either way, gotta believe Thea is beating JC at the end of this feud. Now, we also have Natalya against Lola Vice in NXT Underground, and this was developed further on Tuesday. There was a really damn cool video package with Lola putting herself over while doing MMA training. Natty talked some shit at her during it. There were also two instances of tracking shots as they walked into the arena and later walked backstage, all setting up for a contract signing leading into the first women's underground match. This happened in the underground ring, the contract signing with the lights darkened and such. It was clearly pre-taped before the live show. Natty entered with Carmen Petrovic and signed the contract. Then Lola signed, saying just because she shakes her ass doesn't mean she can't kick ass. Fair enough. Vice said their match would be historic. Natty said the difference between them is she actually respects Lola's MMA background. Lola doesn't respect or understand what she forged in the dungeon. So she promised to beat that respect into her and tap her ass out. Lola claimed she had the fastest hands in the division. And then she welcomed in her training partner, with Shayna Baszler coming out to a huge pop. She said Natty's chances went from slim to none. She shoved Petrovic after insulting her, only for Carmen to catch Shayna with a kick, and Lola got thrown into a bunch of people outside the ring. This was cool as shit, okay? I don't really have much more to say than that. The atmosphere was gritty. The match felt important despite it being a short-term feud. All of the women played their roles perfectly. I would have never believed if you told me I was looking forward to a match between them. But it sure seems like they're going to deliver this in a major way next week. It was such a unique way to showcase women's wrestling that we don't really get to see from WWE or anywhere else. And I hope they stick with this. And I hope some of this permeates to the main roster. This is what I was talking about with so many other things that NXT does. The Battle Royal booking for Monday night. Such a simple concept that NXT uses to use a Battle Royal to crown a champion and make it more legitimate. WWE, the main roster, they don't do stuff like that. The NXT underground concept, I'm okay if that stays there. But a lot could be learned from the way Natty, and by the way, Shayna as well, were presented in this segment. In terms of a prediction, it's tough. Like, on one hand, you think, man, Natalya really should win this. She's the veteran. She's the boat. Like, it's the gimmick, right? But Lola, if she's going to have any success in NXT, she needs to get legitimized. She does have that MMA background, which theoretically should give her an advantage, even though, yes, Natty did train in the dungeon. So I'm going to pick Lola, but I actually do wish and hope that Natty is booked to win. I just don't think that's the plan. The North American Championship is going to be on the line. Oba Femi defending against Ivar. There's really nothing else that happened on Tuesday from this. Gotta believe Oba Femi is going to retain. If someone was going to beat him, it really should have been Dijak. We talked about that at the last premium live event. And also the Tag Team Championships will be on the line. Nathan Frazier and Axiom defending against Authors of Pain. And this one, I just have no idea what's going to happen. It does kind of feel like a title change. Like, I don't see how Frazier and Axiom just beat AOP, given their size, their strength, the fact that they're main roster talents. I hope I'm wrong. I truly do. Frazier and Axiom, I would prefer to be champions. I don't really want... I last week said that Authors of Pain has a different aura in NXT, and they're so much more likable and entertaining down there. And I still believe that. Doesn't mean I want them to be champions. But I actually think that's what's going to happen. So I'm going to go pick Authors of Pain to win the NXT tag team titles. So folks, that wraps up NXT this week. Let's go ahead and move into AEW, where we still have a ton to talk about. Now, before we get into breaking down everything that happened across Collision, Rampage, and Dynamite that, of course, we did not already cover on that AEW Dynasty instant analysis, quick, a recap of all the matches from the show. You guys know we do this. How many are built via storyline? How many are random? We do it every single time. Got to stay consistent here. So this was a little bit more difficult to calculate than normal because there was a pay-per-view, so that excuses certain matches being made. There were also matches that were made for no reason but did include promos preceding them from Collision or Rampage leading into Dynamite. So I split the difference when it came to some of those. Ultimately, I was at 38.5% with storyline reasoning going into the matches themselves, 61.5% without legitimate storyline reasoning going into the matches. And that's on, I guess, the higher end of what it's been of late, but certainly nowhere near what we're asking for, which is like 65 to 70% in a given week. Now, that said, after Dynamite, some of the matches that are booked for Collision and Rampage, they have some storyline reasoning. And those are the shows where usually it's the weakest. So if they capitalize on those and go into Dynamite next week with some real good storyline reasoning for those matches, we may be looking at hitting that number by the next time we talk. And that would be a massive positive for AEW. With that said, let's go ahead and break down everything that happened this week that we have not already spoken about. Now, we are mostly going to cover Dynamite from the onset, and we'll throw in some extra stuff about Collision and Rampage at the end. I just wanted to make it clear the way this was going to be built. We always do it based on storyline, but by far the most important stuff that happened that we have not already discussed, of course, happened on Dynamite this Wednesday. And I should also note, they were at Daly's place in Jacksonville because Tony Khan basically needed to be at the Jaguars facility as they're prepping for the NFL draft Thursday through Saturday. So the Elite opened Dynamite outside Daly's place, gloating with all their titles, before a second black SUV pulled up with Jack Perry exiting. Now, you may wonder, there's only four of them, so why did they take two cars? I can't answer that question for you, but that's what happened. Security tried to prevent Perry from entering the venue, but the Bucks, of course, overruled them and said they had business to handle. Now, audio was absolutely dreadful for a big part of the show, especially this segment. For some reason, AEW didn't use a direct feed, but we heard it echoing out of the venue speakers. I just don't get why they can't put this together. Anyway, later, we saw Perry and the Elite exit Tony Khan's office. He, Kazuchika Okada, and Nick Jackson all refused to answer whether Jack was reinstated, but Matt said Tony agreed to meet face-to-face with Jack live in the ring in the main event of the show. We then saw footage of Perry's New Japan debut in January when he took the scapegoat name. Now, I'm just giving you my live perspective through this announcement. I was stuck to my seat thinking this was going to be must-see cringe TV, just given Tony's history on camera. Obviously, I thought in the moment, it also flies in the face of him saying he had no interest in being an on-air character for AEW. He's been on TV before, but just as himself, not as a quote-unquote character version of himself. And that includes the announcements and all the things that he's done. The only time he's ever really done character work was when he taped those like shit-talking promos for AEW that they aired on Impact. Anyway, getting back to this. So Perry comes out for the main event, and he said he had business to discuss with Khan. So he walked out with Jack saying all that he's ever wanted is what's best for AEW. Tony clapped at that and then banged himself in the chest. And I got to be honest, I laughed out loud, like cackled at the way he was, like the clapping and the banging of his chest, like it was some huge bro moment. Perry asked to shake hands so he could get reinstated and so that they could change the world together. Tony gave the crowd a thumbs up, shook Jack's hand and hugged him. Then, as they were hugging, Jack put his head on Tony's shoulder, cocked it, and smiled. Then he raised Tony's arm three ways around the ring and just punched him right in the gut. Khan fell to the canvas like he got knocked out. And then 5 seconds later, he remembered, oh, wait, I got punched in the stomach. So he started selling the stomach. The Elite ran out seemingly to admonish Perry. Instead, the Bucks lifted Tony by the arms, feigning an EVP trigger. Okada said, no, don't do that. He put his thumbs up. So instead of that, they did the TK driver, the idea being that this is a hostile takeover of AEW by the Elite, with them wanting to make AEW what they always expected it to be, one would think beholden to them. Cameras did botch, Matt saying something off mic. Everyone kind of lingered around for a while. And then once they actually left, a bunch of jobbers and low-card guys eventually came out to the ring. And then eventually, Shad Khan, yes, Shad Khan, went in looking concerned for his son. Unfortunately, Dynamite went off the air seconds after we saw him. I really wanted his like emotional reaction, flipping out, yelling at people. I wanted more of that. But again, the show just went off the air once he got to the ring. So clearly there's a lot to talk about here. Okay. My general reaction, if I could sum it up in a single sentence, is that this was so bad, it was good. And I mean that, I got to be very clear, in the most positive way. Like, it was so corny, and Tony was such a dork, and really, him being out there made it clear, like, Jack is no bigger than this nebbish. But even though we knew something was coming, seeing him get punched in the stomach, struggle to sell properly, and then take the TK driver, and then having Shad come out after it's all over, you could not help but enjoy it, both for the cringe reasons and simply the overall enjoyment of the entire segment. And that's really the point. It was not supposed to be some masterpiece of drama like what you would want from the Bloodline. And really, I have no criticism for Tony showing up here because it really did not fly in the face of his prior comments about not wanting to be an on-screen character, at least not yet. He was basically there as the head of the company, like always, just fulfilling a general duty. Now, look, if they try to pull an NWO and rope him in on it, or if he comes a vocal regular TV presence leading another faction against the Elite, okay, we'll have something to talk and likely complain about. But really here, he was no different than he has been previously. He didn't even speak, and that was obviously for the better. Now, the other side of this is that, look, if we're being totally honest, it was basically impossible to take anything we saw here that seriously. It came across more like Negative One getting a chance to be on TV than it did some hugely important angle that's going to shift the foundation of the company. But it's also impossible to take much from this at all, because success or failure here is only going to be determined in what happens next and going forward. Tony is the sole owner of this company. These guys are talents and EVPs with no legitimate power, and they pretty much tell us that on screen. Khan is already selling this. He's wearing a neck brace. He's keeping kayfabe off TV. I love that so much, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute. But it's not like he's in a coma and he's unable to do his job in AEW. We're going to see him in the Jacksonville Jaguars war room throughout the NFL draft. So if he can do that job, then he can continue with his regular AEW duties starting on Saturday. Now, is there going to be immediate follow-up on Collision? If not, how can that logically be the case given the gravity of the angle? Next week on Dynamite, are the EVPs going to be punished and have their corporate position stripped? If not, why not? It's well within Tony's rights. My point is this needs to be treated in a realistic, legitimate manner for it to actually be something that keeps our interest and makes us want to tune in weekly to see what's going to happen next. Otherwise, if they play it from the standpoint of the Bucks having taken him out and supplanting him and leading AEW, that's going to be nonsensical. It's entirely going to be up to the execution of this to determine whether it succeeds or fails. These are not decisions or determinations that can be made just off of Wednesday night. Couple other notes I had here. I laughed at the group of wrestlers that came to check on him. You didn't get Jon Moxley or Will Ospreay or Orange Cassidy. I know he got attacked earlier in the show. Or any of these other major players on the roster. There were a bunch of luchadors and jobbers plus his dad. Wouldn't some of the stars be concerned about this guy? I'm also curious who winds up leading the charge in defense of AEW. Bryan Danielson does make a lot of sense off the jump. I could also see it being like a returning MJF, but that would probably be 2 months away at the earliest, one would think. Kenny Omega and Hangman Page, there are other options, though with Hangman kind of sort of turning heel, despite not doing anything wrong, he could also align with the Elite. Now, it was announced in the middle of the show that Omega returns to Dynamite next week. He's not going to be wrestling or physically active. He's still recovering. He actually needs surgery. That wasn't announced. I'm just explaining this to you to level set your expectations. You have to believe he's going to be there to confront the Elite, possibly Stardo and Okada for taking the spot. Maybe they're planning to have their first AEW match at All In. Not sure if Kenny's going to be able to wrestle by then. Still a decent ways out, but it could explain him being on TV. And lastly, I'll wrap up with this. The reason why I liked this so much, it's not even really because of what happened on TV. It's because this is the type of promotional effort that can really pay off for AEW, as opposed to the release of the All In footage and the way they handled that bullshit. That footage, even through this segment, it added absolutely nothing to the storyline. I know some people are going to say, well, it explains why Jack is the scapegoat. We all know why he's the scapegoat. You didn't need the footage for that. AEW tells us so many things, or I'm sorry, doesn't tell us so many things. They just assume we know them. Everyone knows that watches AEW, what's happening with Jack Perry, why he wasn't there, etc. The All-In footage did not help to that level. They didn't address it in that way. So let's just get off of that concept. However, having Tony take this bump, it had AEW do a coordinated media effort ahead of the NFL draft. You had NFL.com posting about the pile driver. There were other football-affiliated social media accounts that picked up on it because of that. So AEW got a good amount of crossover press here. And I could certainly see a situation where Tony like wears this neck brace during the 3-day draft with maybe ESPN or NFL Network more likely, maybe both, showing footage and mentioning it on day 3 when things do slow down. That would lead to another round of press. This is how you do it. Not bullshit gimmicks, but smart moves and coordinated efforts that play into your own product. So I give them kudos for this. And again, it's really why I like the angle the most. I do hope he's wearing a neck brace when I watch the NFL draft starting tonight. I do hope that on day 3 of the draft, they somehow mention this and tongue-in-cheek make fun of it. Or maybe Tony even gets interviewed while he's in the brace. That may be a step too far given he's not the actual general manager of the team. I think you're getting my point, though. This is how you do crossover. This is how you do promotion. Not the other bullshit that AEW has been doing for so long. So two thumbs up for all of that. And that's why I liked the angle. Again, as I said, it was so bad, it was good. On Dynamite, the AEW champion, Swerve Strickland, I almost said championship, excuse me, the champion, Swerve Strickland, fought Kyle Fletcher in an eliminator match. So we'll get to that in a second. Swerve sold an injured ankle that Fletcher attacked. He also had a brainbuster before they badly botched a sequence ending in a rotating tombstone piledriver that was more of a front slam. Don Callis signaled something to Fletcher, who went outside and under the ring. He was supposed to get a table. Instead, he changed his mind. He failed trying a superplex. That led to a draping Swerve stomp that was a false finish. Asinine kick out there, given it's the guy's finisher. But he came back with house call to win the eliminator match. Now, the biggest issue here is actually that Swerve didn't get promo time on the first show after winning the title. Now, it makes more sense in retrospect because AEW has announced that Swerve is going to open Collision on Saturday night, and that will feature perhaps AEW's greatest lead-in ever. It's going to come immediately after an NBA playoff game without a barrier for behind the NBA, the post-game show that they have. So having Swerve front and center on Saturday makes total sense. I still think he could have spoken for 1 or 2 minutes here before getting cut off ahead of the match. He is the new AEW champion. We shouldn't have to wait 6 days to hear from him. And of course, the secondary issue is that this match happened for no reason whatsoever. Literally none. Why did Fletcher challenge here? Why would he be allowed to when he's 0-5 in AEW since becoming ROH TV champion? Now he's obviously 0-6. The most interesting part was Callis calling a play and Fletcher ignoring it. That could have happened against anybody. So while it was nice to see Swerve with the title on the show, this did mostly miss the mark for me. On Collision, Powerhouse Hobbs beat a jobber in 80 seconds with a torture rack. I do like that as a submission finisher for him. After the bell, Callis said the scheduled match against Mox on Dynamite would actually be for the IWGP World Heavyweight title because he cashed in a favor he was owed by New Japan for saving their business. On Rampage, Mox addressed the match. He didn't actually say anything other than Hobbs needing to step up against him. Now, in case you're curious, Hobbs does not have a singles win over a full-time talent since February. He's 1-5 on AEW TV this year. He has 2 notable singles wins since October. He's never won a world title in AEW. He has the TNT title. That's the most. And he's fighting now for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship. It's patently absurd. On a positive note, this is just the second time in history that a black man gets to challenge for that title. So that's pretty cool. On Dynamite, we got that match. Mox against Hobbs for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship. Mox cut his typically strong pre-match promo backstage, saying he knows what it takes to stay at the top. Hobbs totally no-sold the German suplex. They fought outside early. Hobbs injured his right knee and limped on it. Mox beat him in the corner, hit paradigm shift for a near fall. Then he locked in a rear naked choke for a referee stoppage because, as always, no one is allowed to submit if they're mid-card or above in AEW. This was actually a terrible match, but assuredly because of the injury. It wasn't that hot before, though. The knee happened. Of course, it tanked from there. Shitty situation. Konosuke Takeshita came out after the bell to stare down Mox. Not that it makes much sense for him to get a title match, but sure, whatever. Starting to wonder whether AEW is building towards like BCC against Callis family, maybe for something like Anarchy in the Arena, Blood and Guts, a match like that, I could definitely see it. On Dynamite, Willow Nightingale got a TBS championship celebration that included Chris Statlander reciting a bad poem and Caprice Coleman doing a prepared rap to her track on commentary. As Willow said, she's the face of TBS. Mercedes Moné entered. Mercedes said she'd take the title. Then she asked if Willow was that bitch who attacked her 2 weeks ago. Stat pointed out that Willow got attacked last week. Nightingale asked Moné if she thinks her New Japan match injury was intentional. Mercedes asked rhetorical questions about her career nearly ending, going through pain and suffering, etc. She said Willow didn't want the truth. She just didn't want to feel guilty. Nightingale talked about doubting herself after the match, wondering if she could have beaten Moné at 100%. Strangely, she kept talking directly into the camera when Mercedes was standing right next to her. Then Willow said there's no asterisk next to her TBS title. She wants to prove she can beat Mercedes without any doubt. Mercedes said Willow knows that she can't beat her. When she turned away, Stat got angry and grabbed Mercedes' arm, which led to Mercedes unknowingly, or unwittingly, I should say, slapping Willow and them getting separated, even though it was Stat who grabbed her. Now, the most interesting part of this, of course, was the ending, because we've now seen a couple instances of Stat being in situations where it looks like she might be turning or she does something that negatively affects Willow, whether on purpose or by happenstance. Also, we're talking about these lights out attacks and they've been blaming Julia Hart. Clearly, it's not Julia Hart. Otherwise, you wouldn't say, oh, it's Julia Hart. I have to believe it's Statlander, the one that's doing this to Mercedes, making her think it might be Willow. and then doing it to Willow, making her think it might be Mercedes. And that could potentially lead, maybe not at Double or Nothing, but after that, maybe to a triple threat or maybe just a stat Willow feud. So it does seem like something is happening there. It was nice to see Nightingale get some bass in her voice and stand up for herself versus the largely like happy go lucky gimmick that she has usually. Mercedes also had uncommon inflection in her voice, probably because she's moving into the direction of an entitled, overconfident heel, which is where she's always been at her best. The babyface role, it's never been right for her. This was probably the best segment of the first hour. You know what? Not probably. This was the best segment of the first hour of Dynamite. Also on Dynamite, we had an international championship, number one contendership, casino gauntlet match. And if that sounds like a mouthful, it's because it is. This segment began without us knowing until entrances that A, it was happening, B, that the winner got a title shot at Double or Nothing, or C, the rules, which were not straightforward whatsoever. Now, this was all explained as Jay White and Dante Martin made their way to the ring. Commentary told us they had no idea who was in the match. Why didn't they? They also told me, or us, that it would be sudden death with the first pinfall or submission earning the title opportunity. So it actually was not a gauntlet match. It was a scramble to a single fall. Just completely misnamed and totally convoluted to that end. That said, there was some good action in the match. Penta El Zero Miedo and Kyle O'Reilly joined after the commercial. Will Ospreay was fifth and had a stare down with White. Lance Archer and Commander also joined, countering a powerbomb into a hurricanrana. That sent Archer through two tables. At this juncture, I found myself wondering why there was no rhyme or reason to the competitors in the match. Half the folks in this match are constant losers, or they're guys who haven't done anything in singles. Ospreay countered Blade Runner into a Liger Bomb for a 3.1 miscount. Jay Lethal joined. Then we learned there are up to 21 wrestlers eligible for this match. Why? Ospreay and O'Reilly had an awesome sequence. Ospreay stopped himself from doing Tiger Driver 91, which he said in the scrum after Dynasty he was retiring. That was not something announced on TV, and it did wind up being a throwaway line by commentary as this was happening. I'll come back to that in a moment, though. Ospreay caught Commander with Hidden Blade after he had landed a moonsault, and he got the win. Undisputed Kingdom, in its entirety, entered and Strong went face-to-face with Ospreay. This was the TV match of the week for AEW. At the same time, had it been tightened up with pre-announced rules, competitors who made sense, and a shorter field, it would have been even better. I saw some complaining about them going to this length for the international title, but not the AEW title. I'm fine with mid-card titles having open fields of competitors. At the same time, I'm not fine with Archer, Lethal, and Commander being in this at all. 3.75 stars, B+. Now, credit to AEW for explaining the deal with Ospreay retiring Tiger Driver 91 later, because there was a backstage segment with Callis and Fletcher in which this was addressed. Callis was insisting that Ospreay use it, particularly against Strong because he has neck problems. Fletcher pointed out Ospreay won anyway, so what's the big deal? It's clear that Fletcher is going to split from Callis. And given this was the first real meaningful interaction we've had between Ospreay and Callis since Will debuted as a full-timer, obviously we know he will split from him as well. Could see Ospreay losing to Strong, maybe due to Callis family interference, and the ensuing story from there is like Ospreay and Fletcher against Konosuke, Takeshita, and Hobbs. That would make a lot of sense. On Dynamite, Chris Jericho, as the Learning Tree, celebrated his FTW title win with the new gimmick he's been playing as basically a guy who's so up his own ass he believes he's helping young talent when he's actually being an asshole and holding them down. I forgot to note, he came out to new graphics and Spotlight, which is a different Fozzy song that is not Judas. He said Hook needs to drop everyone around him, including Taz, and he talked about so many wrestlers entering the Jericho vortex and coming out better. He trademarked that term, by the way, so of course, he's trying to embrace the hate. Big Bill entered on his own, asking for Jericho's guidance, calling him the Socrates of professional wrestling. He said that young talent should be chomping at the bit. Everyone, the phrase is champing at the bit. So he said everyone should be champing at the bit to be tutored by him, but he's the best fit for the Learning Tree. Jericho said he would pay attention and watch Bill. Now, on one hand, it seems like Jericho is about to start his third faction. But as I've said for weeks now, I'm far more interested in this than many of you. And I'm a huge fan of the gimmick concept. Inner Circle will probably be unmatched, but it's not going to take much for him to do better than JAS. Big Bill is a great start, a perfect fit alongside Jericho. We've seen him be serious. We've seen him be comedic. Them as a 1-2 punch. I love it. Jericho being self-aware about the criticism and playing into it with this new character and storyline. It's usually when he's at his best. So I'm really into this. Later, Katsuyori Shibata challenged Jericho for the FTW title in Jericho's hometown of Winnipeg. because he told Hook that, of course, he should drop Shibata as dead weight. It's going to be interesting to see if Big Bill gets involved here or how exactly this transpires. On Dynamite, Trent Beretta attacked Orange Cassidy as he made his entrance during the first segment of the show. It was a relatively mild beatdown. Chuck Taylor entered from the crowd with Trent apologizing for everything with Orange going wrong. He said that they brought him into Best Friends to make him their mascot, but instead they became his lackeys. Trent said he was his actual friend, referring to Chuck, and that he loved him. Then he extended his arms out for a hug. Chuck feigned a hug. Instead, he called Trent a piece of shit. He finally got to say shit on television.
With a tear in my eye.
And then he hit him in the head with the mic. Taylor said AEW won't clear him for a match, so he challenged Trent to a parking lot brawl. Obviously, they had a great match doing that, I think with PNP back in the day, so there's consistency there. Now, this was a dreadful segment, like from an acting standpoint, but the storyline made sense. The only way it really, though, works is if Trent beats Chuck, setting up a big feud match with Orange, especially given Taylor is saying that he's injured. Also, Trent spit nothing but facts during his promo. I know he's the heel, but he made a lot of really, really good points, and Chuck should probably be siding with him over Orange, if we're being honest. On Dynamite, Thunder Rosa backstage said she was proud of her effort at Dynasty when Deonna Purrazzo came up. They started arguing with a lot of hand-talking and gestures in each other's faces. They got broken up. They're going to have a match this coming weekend. Also on Dynamite, Anna Jay fought Mina Shirakawa. Good job by AEW here. Not only giving background on Mina, but reminding us that this match actually had a reason for happening, even though Mina's initial debut in AEW was barely explained. Mariah May was ringside with her friend. Anna got distracted by Mariah just standing ringside while she was putting Mina in Queenslayer, which allowed Mina to counter her into a really tight pinning combination for the win. The heel celebrated again with champagne. Anna attacked and put Maria in Queenslayer until Toni Storm made the save. Then Serena Deeb randomly walked out, picked up the title that Toni left on the ramp, and spoke into the camera without a mic. She actually said she was making a promise to everyone who could hear my voice right now, which was so ironic because you could barely hear her voice. Anyway, the promise was that she would become women's champion. I'm not sure how else to explain this other than by saying all of the individual parts were totally fine and sensible, but together it came across as a total mess. As mentioned earlier, the audio production was an issue all night. Playing Serena's theme at full volume through the speakers while expecting her to speak into the camera without a mic, it was so ridiculously dumb. The match was nothing special. Half the folks involved, no one cares about. But despite all of that, Toni did get a fantastic pop, and she remains super over. So that pretty much wraps up Dynamite. Couple additional items from last weekend. On Rampage, Rob Van Dam beat Isaiah Cassidy, Commander, and Lee Johnson in what was called the High-Flying 420 Elimination Match. You know, because weed. Get it? If RVD was not high as balls during this match, I would be shocked. He looked absolutely wrecked walking to the ring. He moves so much slower than he has recently. The finish was a 5-star frog splash, pinning Commander. On Collision, Sky Blue beat Layla Hirsch in 5 minutes, the only women's match on the show. Hirsch badly botched a springboard type of move and ate a TKO into the Dragon Sleeper. On Rampage, Yuka Sakazaki beat Emi Sakura in a match that happened for no reason, and even worse, it was terrible. And even worse, it included the referee not understanding the level to which Yuka injured herself. She was literally testing her ankle or leg walking around the ring, including trying to jog on it, and they just kept the entire match going. Then she got hurt a second time later. She motioned to the referee that she was done. He did nothing about it. Credit to her for gutting it out, but you could tell she was hurt and she was pissed off in the finish. It was so ridiculous.
I hate this. I hate this crap. Stop. Stop with the crap.
And lastly, we mentioned this last week, but it was taped for Rampage and we got to see it Saturday. Angelo Parker cut a promo about it being a rough year professionally, but a great one personally because he met the love of his life in Ruby Soho. But now that he's lost her, he has nothing left to fight for, and he was going to retire. Ruby interrupted right as he was saying the word retire. She was saying that he has plenty left to fight for because she's pregnant. And she was so angry at him fighting because she didn't know how to tell him. They made out, and they celebrated to end it. And as we mentioned, this was a total shoot. Super sweet moment. And on the back end, the story certainly makes more sense from Ruby's standpoint. It doesn't suddenly make Zack Knight a worthwhile part of TV, though. I feel like doing this announcement ahead of the match and then having Parker beat Knight would have been much better booking. It's not like they're writing Angelo off TV because his girlfriend is pregnant and she's not even showing yet. You know what I mean? So I got what they were doing. I still think it could have been executed a million times better than what we actually got over the last like 2 months of TV that we've had to suffer through this. So folks, that wraps up AEW this week. As you can tell, Silver King was very, very positive about AEW. I thought Dynamite was a damn good show. I thought that the Tony Khan moment at the end, for any issues you might have, any criticisms, whatever, from a promotional standpoint, to get crossover promotional appeal, it was very smart. And again, cringe, yes. So bad that it was good, yes. But that means it was good at the end. And again, I think it's successful for them. That's massively positive as well. Also, other multiple good segments on the show, as mentioned. And it kind of feels like to me, and I know people are saying, and AEW's been kicking ass all of 2024. I don't totally agree with that. I think both pay-per-views were great. TV has been a total mixed bag as far as I was concerned. This Dynamite felt to me like the type of episode you can build upon through multiple storylines. And I don't want to say get back to when they were their best, but to get into a groove that can have them coast and be successful for the remainder of 2024. And when I say coast, I don't mean take your foot off the gas. I just mean continue to have success without being interrupted. That's what I meant. Now, I did say I was going to talk about ratings, and I will do that briefly. So Dynamite on Wednesday did 683,000 viewers and a 0.23 demo. What needs to be noted here is that the West Coast feed aired live. And usually when that happens, ratings go down anywhere between 5 to 10%. You can't give an exact number because you just don't know how many people otherwise would have watched at 8 and how many just decided not to. But what's so interesting here is that NXT on Tuesday did 660,000 viewers and a 0.2 rating. So you're talking about a difference of 23,000 viewers and a 0.03 demo. I said rating twice a minute ago or a second ago. I meant demo. That is crazy close. And as I've said, every single time we talk about ratings, AEW cannot beat NXT. NXT cannot beat AEW. AEW cannot beat Raw. Why? Because they air on different nights at different times and they're not going head to head. However, when you consider the level of competition that NXT was going up against on Tuesday, multiple massive NBA playoff games, whereas Dynamite only went up against one on Wednesday, the fact that these were so close is crazy interesting. The 0.23 demo has been a low that they've reached multiple times already this year, and it's an immensely low demo that they've hit three times in the last 5 weeks. 683,000 viewers was the lowest since AEW did go head-to-head with NXT on October 10th. But of course, that was a moved night, and I believe a moved time as well, but at least a moved night, they did 609,000. It was their lowest just viewership rating in their normal time slot since I believe their first show of 2021. AEW Dynamite has not done ratings this low in its normal time slot in like at least 3 years or so. So it's still extremely notable that ratings are going down to that level. And the NXT rating too, it's not really anything for it to hang its hat on. I mean, sure, it was the highest viewership they've had despite the competition that they were going against. It was the highest viewership since January 16th of this year. And it was the highest demo, or I should say tied the highest demo since January 9th. Of this year, but let's not forget, in late 2023, they were some weeks doing like 798 and 0.26. Like they were doing some big ratings, and that included, yes, main roster talent on there and so on and so forth. So is it a decent rating for 2024 for NXT? Yes. And you know what? You could even make an argument that if the NBA playoffs weren't going on, it might have been their highest rating of 2024, but it's still down from what we know they can do when they really give full faith and effort into that product. So again, it's not a comparison. It's not a head-to-head situation, but still the fact that those two shows were that close in their regular time slots with AEW airing live on the West Coast, again, 5 to 10%, you know, decrease in traffic or in viewership. It is still something to note as we kind of continue through this time period where NXT, you think, is gearing up for the CW in October. And AEW right now still does not have a new TV contract. As I've said multiple times, they're going to get one. They're going to get a lot more money than they're currently making, but it isn't done. Hasn't been announced. And if you're not pulling in high ratings and you haven't finalized anything, then there is a motivational disadvantage, I guess, that you could say the networks possibly competing for your rights or the main network that you're negotiating with, which of course is Turner, Warner Brothers, I should say, There's a disadvantage there when you're not kicking ass in ratings. Now, coming out of this Tony Khan storyline and all this extra press they're getting with the NFL, could that change going into next week? Maybe they pop a rating. Certainly possible. We will have to find out next week. All right, folks, this was an extended edition of the Getting Over Wrestling podcast covering all things NXT and AEW, The Silver King. And for the other two shows, Vintage Chris Vanini, we've done a lot of talking this week. So allow me to rest my voice and remind you on the way out that the Getting Over Wrestling podcast
is all about Defy.
So head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave those 5-star ratings on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You'll get bonus audio, instant reactions to Raw, NXT Dynamite, and SmackDown, plus exclusive news posts every Friday. All of that at buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. As I mentioned earlier in the show, we have 2 WWE episodes already in the can from this week. The full breakdown of Becky Lynch winning the women's world title and everything else that happened across SmackDown and Raw. And then a separate episode, a mock WWE draft ahead of the start of the actual WWE draft this Friday and Monday. We, of course, will go through all of those results and the entire week in WWE next Tuesday in our normal spot. And then next Thursday, same bat time, same bat channel, we'll have your next NXT and AEW episode. Thank you all for listening. This is the Silver King signing off, leaving you with just 3 final words. Bye for now.